This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
Usually when we talk about class on this program, it's one of those things they have in school. Today, not so much. Social status, or class, isn't something we really talk about much here in the U.S. Okay, during election season, we hear the term middle class thrown around like crazy. But other than that, it's almost a taboo topic. But ignoring the issue doesn't change the issue. Class matters.
There's some class mobility, but most people end up at approximately the education level, income level type of occupation as their parents.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll talk to the author of a new book about class in the U.S. and a new study which focused on the class divisions in the activist community. We'll also spend an academic minute looking at the stigma of prejudice. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. We've been told for years that the United States is a classless society. Perhaps we should call that class-free. But the point is, we may not call it class, but divisions by social status surely do exist. Betsy Leonderwhite dives right into this topic with her new book, Missing Class: How Seeing Class Cultures Can Strengthen Social Movement Groups. Betsy Leonderwhite is a longtime social activist and the program director for the organization Class Action. We spoke recently, and I asked her just how important is the concept of class in the U.S.
Well, there's this myth that we're a classless society that, of course, is completely false. There's some class mobility. You know, we're supposed to be the land of opportunity, but it's gotten less over the years, and most people end up at approximately the education level, income level type of occupation as their parents. So we clearly are a class stratified society, but it's one of those topics that's a big taboo, as if you're not supposed to talk about it. And at Class Action, we found that that's actually really harmful to say, oh, we're all middle class, or that's something we're not going to talk about. There's real downsides to that, and it's really helpful to be honest with each other about the differences in our class life experience.
In your book, you talk a lot about activist class. What do you mean by that?
So I specifically looked at membership groups. Lots of people have been in some form of membership group, even if it's in the neighborhood or their kid's school. But I specifically looked at groups with a social change agenda, groups trying to make the world or their community a better place. And I studied 25 groups in 5 states. So I'm shorthanding the members as activists, and they were in a lot of different movement traditions: the labor movement, the environmental movement, community organizing, a lot of different types of membership groups. And what I was looking for was to see whether approaches to group problems were handled differently depending on those movement traditions, but also depending on the predominant class of the membership. And I found out that, sure enough, a ton of things correlated with class once I learned the life stories of several hundred of the members of these 25 groups, that how you approach conflict, for example, varies a lot by class. How you think, if you don't have enough people in your group, how do you recruit? That's a problem every group has, right? It's not enough people turning out. People thought about that question very differently depending on their class background and their current class. So I found that this could be a really useful thing to know if you want to strengthen your own group so that it reaches its goals better, and also if you want to work with other groups across class, if you want to build cross-class alliances, which in my belief is the only way we're really going to make things better in this country, is if people come together across class and other lines.
You talk about recruiting people to a different group. Do you mean trying to get people to change their quote-unquote class in life?
No, I mean, like, if you are a community organizing group and, you know, you could really get something done, you could really put some pressure on City Hall if you could get 100 people to turn up, but instead you've only got the same 20 people turning up.
So it's something that you do talk in depth about in the book called Activating the Inactive.
Right. That's another very common problem is, yes, you've got people, they are members, but they don't do anything. They don't speak up. They don't take on tasks. And so you've just got that hard core. When you ask people, what don't you like about your voluntary group, that's a perennial one. And what I found was that there were really different approaches depending on your class of what you thought would work to get those inactive people active. And college-educated activists had an approach of, let's facilitate group processes that require everyone to speak. And sometimes that works, but it backfired with quite a number of people who didn't like the stylized group process techniques, and in particular disempowered and experienced working class and poor people pretty much, you know, felt put on the spot and disliked the processes, and it just seemed to make things worse. So there was another form of activating the inactive that I saw done by leaders of grassroots and labor groups. And they really made a one-on-one connection with each new person. They would have one-on-one meetings with them. They would ask them directly to take on little tasks, which, of course, is the when you get trained to be a community organizer, that's what you get trained to do, ask somebody to bring cookies this time and then take the flyers to the library next time, and pretty soon they're going to be, you know, speaking at your rally. But that very, very different approach is the group collection of people who each have a trusting bond with the leader or leaders, which is how it tends to be in the working class majority groups, or is it where someone's just stepping into this facilitation role where everyone's treated the same and asked to do the same group process?
Let's get back to class itself. What are the classes, so to speak, that exist in the U.S. now? Is it just 1, 2, 3, or are there, you know, gray areas in there?
Yeah. Well, this is one of the tricky things about talking about class, because class is a series of spectrums, of interwoven spectrums, and you can take a spectrum and you can divide it into, you know, like the IRS does, how many tax brackets are we? You can divide it into a dozen different categories. You can just say two. There's like the rich and the poor, the haves and the have-nots. You know, a couple of things I'd say in answer to that. One is to say there's a four-way division that seems to really fit with some big differences in our lived experience. So I would say the four-year college education and professional managerial jobs, that's a real divide, that if you don't have that four-year degree, you're probably working in a more closely supervised job, maybe for wages. Even if you're pretty prosperous, you're really working class in your life experience of this economy. And within that group that has to work for wages, if you are chronically poor, if for two generations or many decades your family is outside the formal labor force and is either on public assistance or scraping by with little bits of temporary work, part-time work, that's a really different standpoint with which to see this whole system. And that's what these really are, is like they each give you a unique perspective where you know some things that other people don't know. Poor people know a lot about this economy that the rest of us don't know, but it also cuts you off from some kinds of knowledge and from gaining some kinds of skills. So I'd say chronic poverty, working class, I hate that word middle class because that's a politician weasel word, you know, used so vaguely as to not mean anything. So I would say professional middle class is the name for when you've got a four-year degree and that autonomy and a little bit more security from a professional managerial job. You're probably a homeowner who can trade up the bigger houses over the years. But you still have to work for a living. And so then my fourth category would be owning class. If you have enough investments, you may be a professional, may go to the same schools as professional middle-class people, but if you have enough investments that you don't really have to work to live, again, that's a really different perspective. My point is that coming into activism or into some kind of mission-driven voluntary group, having each of those class backgrounds gives you distinct gifts, and we need the gifts of all classes. But we mostly can't do that because we don't even know who's in the group by class, because we've never talked about class backgrounds. A lot of times people are guessing wrong. They're equating race and class. Literally, I found out that the majority of people's guesses about other group members' class backgrounds were wrong.
Well, that's one thing about class is we don't wear badges.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. You walk into a room, most of us have a habit of pretty much instantly sussing up who's in the room by race and by gender, and we might be guessing wrong about somebody, but we more or less know. And so if there are race or gender dynamics going on in the room, or some group, more privileged group is dominating, or there's underrepresentation, pretty much everybody has the same vocabulary for that, and everybody sees the same thing. We are at such a more basic level in the conversation about class identities and who's in the room. I've discovered through doing Class Action Does workshops where we encourage people to tell pieces of their class life story, and there are secrets. There are class secrets in every room. There are people hiding hardships from their past, like bankruptcies or times of homelessness, and there are people hiding luxuries. They're hiding second homes and trust funds and having all these secrets. And so it looks like we're more all roughly the same. It's just not healthy.
On the other hand, you don't want to be in the room with somebody flaunting their wealth. Nobody wants to be that guy.
Right. So there's a lot, there's an obnoxious way, right, to
I know a few, yes.
Yeah, so do I. Yeah, you know, because of the types of groups that I studied, where I guess you'd say they're left of center, although not all of them would use that word, but because they're on the progressive causes, I didn't find much of that. In fact, I found that paradoxically, in some circles, it's more cool, it has more status if you're in an oppressed group. And you can't as easily fake an oppressed race or gender status. So there's a lot of posing as working class to get that kind of movement credibility or being able to be the spokesperson for the people, you know, and a lot of hiding or downplaying privileges. Like, I remember one woman just instantly introducing herself to the researcher by telling about how awful it was when she was on welfare. The welfare office was just impossible to deal with. And then later, through her interview and her questionnaire, turns out she comes from a pretty elite upper middle class family. She has a graduate degree. She has worked professional jobs. But yes, there was a time she was poor as a single mom when her kids are little. But those other things weren't the first to get mentioned. But she wanted to establish her credibility as one of the people that the group represented.
Still to come, my conversation with Dr. Betsy Leonderide continues with a look at a group who voluntarily move down in class. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. You can start your own archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for The Best of Our Knowledge, number 1232. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Our guest today is Betsy Leonderide, a social activist and the author of the new book, Missing Class: How Seeing Class Cultures Can Strengthen Social Movement Groups. We're talking about the role of class in the U.S., and I asked her about another group she mentions in the book, the voluntarily downwardly mobile. You have another group that you talk about, which is the voluntarily downwardly mobile.
That's right.
Now, tell us about those, because I found that interesting.
Yeah, so this is not a very common group within the population of the U.S. as a whole, but in these progressive activist circles, it is quite common that this is people whose parents went to college and have professional managerial careers, and they went to college themselves and then made choices not to pursue a career track, but to put their time, you know, volunteer their time or work for very low-paid nonprofit work or work part-time so they can be an activist or be an artist. And for some of whom, it's an environmental ideal that going off the grid and lowering their carbon footprint is, so they're trying to consume as little as possible and opt out of a system that they think is harmful. For others, they probably would actually like their income to be higher, but they don't want to give up the work that's so important to them. So, yeah, anywhere from just people going into helping professions instead of more lucrative careers is moderately downwardly mobile. But the biggest clump was, I don't know if you're familiar with the young anarchist subculture, groups like Food Not Bombs that gives away free vegetarian food in a lot of cities, and critical mass that promotes bike riding. There's a lot of groups whose political philosophy is anarchist. They tend to be young, white, from privileged class backgrounds, post-college, college students or post-college. And they had really, really distinct ways of doing things. And I'm eager to talk to more groups in that category because there were a lot of ways that they didn't see how their class background was getting into their groups, that they're trying to be very, very different than the mainstream. They're trying to be the change that they want to see, which is an admirable goal. And so they're repudiating a lot of the consumerism of their backgrounds and the sexism and racism that they were brought up with, and that's great. But because they're currently living at a poverty level, there's very little recognition or discussion in some of the anarchist groups about the class culture that they, how were they socialized as kids to behave. And there are just some really counterproductive ways of acting taken from their backgrounds being played out in an unexamined way. They were by far the most critical group of their own groups and of each other, which I think is something you learn in elite colleges, to be sort of the critic and the judge of other people. Some of them were real conflict avoiders. So those are just a couple examples of people desperately wanting to be different than the society they grew up in and yet replicating some of the same bad habits.
There's one other group I want to talk about, and that's the straddlers.
Yes.
What do you have to do to be a straddler?
Straddler, there's a great book about straddlers, which is Upwardly Mobile People by Al Lubrano. He coined that term in the book Limbo, where he interviews a lot of people who grew up in working class or poor families, were the first generation in their family to go to college, and so now are in a different class than their parents, their families of origin. A lot of progressive activists are straddlers. I would run into straddlers, like there were a lot of people I just assumed, because I knew about their current jobs and home ownership, that seemed like, oh, yeah, here's a professional middle class person. Turns out there's a working class backstory, and I think a lot of people turn to progressive activism, like anti-poverty groups, to be true to their roots. So they've gone on to have a professional career, but they want to be loyal to the people they come from and bring up other people up the ladder behind them. So many straddlers were really great, effective activists, especially those who had established a new, a new class lifestyle. There was a subset that I call the unassimilated straddlers who had brought some class, working class rage from their backgrounds and then had gotten a whole ideological way of talking about that and a sort of harsh judgmental way of communicating from going to college and then had been uprooted from their roots and yet had not settled down, say, into a suburban neighborhood or a professional career. So really lacked accountability to anyone. And so there were very few repercussions on them if they started fights within, not physical fights, but started arguments within groups or criticized people very harshly. And so it was funny to, I was expecting the straddlers to be the cross-class bridge people because they're straddling two classes. They should be able to talk the lingo of how they grew up and their class now, and there were some people like that, but I found this whole almost opposite strand where people are coming into groups just really, really wanting the college-educated professionals to get it, the things that were important to people like their own class roots, and so just really pushing their ideologies, really pushing their moral certainties, sometimes constructively and sometimes in ways that were really problematic that other people in the group didn't like. So I had so many surprises. You know, I had some hypotheses about what would activist class cultures be? How would people of a certain class profile tend to act in a group? Most of them were wrong. You know, most of my guesses were wrong. And I think that was one of them where I was like really surprised.
Well, finally, is a classless society possible? And is it even something worth striving to get?
I think we'll always have some degree of inequality, and there certainly will always be a need for all different kinds of jobs to be done in our society, that there's always going to be hands-on work and caring work as well as professional managerial work. There's no reason, though, that service jobs or blue-collar jobs need to pay badly. And so that's really what's wrong now. The society we have now has too many extremes. We're letting millions of people work hard but not get a living wage, and that should be completely unacceptable in any decent democratic society. And we're letting people just accumulate billions upon billions, in some cases through shady mortgage practices and financial practices. And so though clearly I'd like to see both the government, but through the public sector, our elected officials, and also through the kinds of social movements that these groups I talk to are trying to build, I'd like to see some accountability for we should have fairer rules. We should have rules where hard work is rewarded and shady practices are not rewarded. So it won't ever be 100% classless, but it could be a whole lot fairer than it is now.
Dr. Betsy Leander Wright is the program director for the group Class Action and the author of the new book, Missing Class: How Seeing Class Cultures Can Strengthen Social Movement Groups. You can learn more online at classmatters.org.
He's pulled a heart like hands on me. Can't afford a Rolls or a Bentley. He has to buy a second-hand Ford.
As we all know, different social classes can lead to prejudice. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Welcome to the Academic Minute. I'm Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College. We all benefit from constructive criticism from time to time. But as Jessica Remedios, assistant professor of psychology at Tufts University, reveals, for individuals from stigmatized groups, distinguishing between helpful criticism and prejudice can be a complicated process.
Understanding why people treat one another as they do helps to distinguish between advice that should be taken or ignored. For example, students may take a trusted mentor's advice to revise a paper because the mentor has little reason to mislead the student about his writing abilities. This seemingly simple process is more complicated for stigmatized people. Stigmatized people experience prejudice based on characteristics like skin color or gender. What does the above example have to do with prejudice? Discussions about prejudice often focus on how to stop people from judging others in biased ways. These discussions are important, but they are not the whole story. Consider how everyday decisions may be complicated for people who routinely encounter prejudice. If a minority student learns that a paper must be revised, that student may wonder if the feedback truly speaks to his abilities, or if the source of the feedback is somehow racist. In a well-known study, white students who received feedback from a white evaluator felt good about themselves if the feedback was positive, but felt bad about themselves if the feedback was negative. Black students reacted differently. They felt bad if the feedback was positive, but felt good if the feedback was negative. Black students were wary that the white evaluator might be prejudiced. They were distrustful of positive feedback and dismissive of negative feedback. This uncertainty can cause stigmatized people to ignore helpful, genuine feedback or believe and internalize unfair, prejudiced feedback. It is important to examine how understanding others' advice may be even more difficult for people, like minority women, who routinely encounter both racism and sexism. Stepping into the shoes of stigmatized people allows us to glimpse how the environment changes when we may be judged by our group memberships rather than our own abilities.
That was Jessica Remedios of Tufts University.
Production support for the Academic Minute comes from Newman's Own Foundation in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at wamc.org.